Welcome to the Think Act Be podcast. This is Seth Gillihan. In this week's episode, I talk with Dr. Jason Hunt. Jason's a clinical psychologist with practices in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and he's a highly skilled clinician. He has clinical experience from the Center for the Treatment and Study of Anxiety at the University of Pennsylvania, from the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, from Friends Hospital, Philadelphia, and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, among other places. He's also worked in prisons at McGuire Air Force Base and in various forensic settings. Jason recently opened a treatment center called Behavioral Health and Anxiety Reduction, which you'll hear him describe, and he's finding high-impact ways to deliver the most effective treatments for conditions like anxiety, depression, insomnia, and others. I love talking with Jason, which I think you'll be able to tell, and hearing his perspective on many issues related to mental health. Jason's very down to earth, and there's an openness and an honesty that come through when you talk to him. So we spoke for almost 2 hours, and there were a lot of topics I would have liked to explore with him in more depth, hopefully on a second installment with Jason. For now, I hope you enjoy our discussion, and thank you, as always, for listening. Well, I am talking with Dr. Jason Hunt. Jason, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored that you decided to have me for this.
Oh, my goodness. Of course. And it's a great excuse to catch up with you and talk. I know it's been
a long time.
It's been a long time. Yeah. So last time I saw you would have been at the Center for the Treatment and Study of Anxiety at Penn. Is that right?
Yes. I think that may have been 2012.
2012. Okay. Yeah. I was trying to remember when. So I guess it was toward the end of my time there. I was there from 08 to 12. And I was, so that was when I was on the faculty there. And I was a
research practicum student.
Research practicum student, right. Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, right?
Exactly. Yes. I was doing my externship there, and I was actually so excited. Interesting story how I got involved with that. I was having some difficulty finding an externship. So I believe I got an externship at Cooper after sort of finagling and trying to sort of use some back sources and just talking to different colleagues, and I was able to get over at Cooper. And at the same time, because I was desperately trying to find an externship, because I think all of them got snatched up, I came across the Penn externship, and I was so enamored by the program and work with Dr. Foa that I actually requested to just volunteer there. So it really wasn't even an externship program for me as much as I just said, hey, you know, I love what you do. I just want to learn about anxiety. I want to learn how to treat it. I want to be the best at it. So do you mind if I just volunteer here?
This was on top of the Cooper placement?
Yeah. So that year I actually did two externships.
Wow.
It was really cool. But everybody was just so nice and so gracious. You know, Dr. Foa, you, Dr. Yusko, Dr. Capaldi, and Carmen was my one of my supervisors there too.
Right. And, yes. Well, I know we were sure happy to have you there. I was still the director of research at that point, and you were a big help.
So you guys just brought me on top, and you said, well, you know, instead of just volunteering every now and again, why don't you just jump on in and be a research practicum student? So I got a chance to do some evaluations and evaluating for OCD and for PTSD, and some really great clinical experiences there. And I got a chance to treat some patients. So it was really a special time that I carry with me to this day. One of my specialties now is anxiety disorders. So invaluable experience.
Yes. You and I think feel the same way about our time there and what we learned from it and how, as far as I know, there's really not a better place to learn about treating anxiety.
Yeah, definitely.
We'll talk more about that's actually, by coincidence, not the only place that you and I have been in common, although not at the same time. But I'm interested in you know, thinking with you more about what you learned about treating anxiety and OCD. What did you take from your time there?
So it's kind of hard to explain, but I guess I learned the underpinnings of what causes it. And I feel like when you have a better understanding for what causes it and what's the sort of acting mechanism to sort of promote anxiety disorders, then you can kind of have some freedom to choose your interventions and just kind of connect with the patient in ways where I don't think you necessarily could if you didn't have that deeper understanding. So for example, like I know that all anxiety disorders, the acting mechanism is going to be that fight or flight response. So I just need to understand, you know, how that's being activated in a patient, and pretty much what types of interventions would best suit that patient so we can sort of get them going and feeling more like themselves. So it's kind of, I don't know if I captured it, you know, in a clearer way, but that's kind of like a general way of how I approach treating anxiety.
I think that's a great point about understanding what drives it. And I think that was one of the advantages of being in a center like where we were, where you really get a mix of, I mean, there's a strong grounding in the theory of the conditions that you're treating and also the interventions. And I'm with you. When you have an understanding, a deeper understanding of the mechanisms that are driving the person's experience, then you have more options in terms of how you intervene.
Yeah, and it reduces therapist burnout. It empowers patients because they're actually making progress that they thought that they could never make. One of the conditions that I really love treating is panic attacks, panic disorder. And patients are so consistently surprised that in just a few appointments, they're able to better regulate their anxiety, reduce panic attacks, reduce the occurrence, and also reduce the severity. Just by learning a few simple techniques about identifying their triggers, regulating their breathing, recognizing that it is a panic attack, and it's not a medical condition, it's not a heart attack, it's not an aneurysm. You might think you're dying, but you're not. So just a few simple techniques, a lot of times can get patients right back on track.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I also treat a lot of panic, and boy, that is a condition that really can just shut a person's life down.
Yeah, it's so debilitating.
So debilitating and understandably so. I don't know if you've experienced panic attacks. I've had a few in my life, and my goodness, what I would give to avoid situations that trigger them.
Absolutely. And yes, I have experienced it one time in my life, and it was actually once over the past 2 years. And if I didn't have a good understanding of what was happening, then it would have been a lot worse than it was. But it was actually during the funeral for my father, and it was as the pallbearers were taking the casket out, and I had the thought that this is the last time that I'm going to be in the same room with my father, and I began to feel really lightheaded, and my heart was racing, and the room became kind of surreal, and I needed to sit back down. And you know, if I didn't recognize in that moment that I'm having a panic attack, I don't know what would have happened. I probably would have escalated and got even worse.
Wow, and there's so many layers to that experience, and I can easily imagine, as you said, if you hadn't known what it was, it could have gone quite differently.
Yeah. And really that's, for me, that's how I connect with my patients. I use a lot of my own personal experiences. You know, I let patients know what I'm going through, what I have gone through, just to lend a little bit of credibility. So there is some self-disclosure that I use when I'm treating patients, but it's kind of like a two-pronged approach, you know? So I let them know what the research says, what we should expect, what are, you know, traditional norms for conditions, disorders, typical reactions. And then I let them know like what my personal experience was. So I say, you know, this isn't just something I read in a book. This is something that I went through. And, you know, what we would typically expect is that you know, maybe a few months is the course of this condition until you start to get back to your normal functioning, or maybe a couple of years would be the course, you know, depending on, you know, what the presenting problem is. So that's kind of how I approach treating patients and how I join and connect with them.
It's such a strong combination. On the one hand, having the scientific backing and the evidence base, and then also making it very real and personal and relevant, and finding a connection for sure, being able to communicate that understanding, and also just for ourselves, having been through these experiences, those things become ways we can understand what the other person is going through on a different level than if we just learned about a condition. You know, it's such a different experience to have had panic than to read a list of symptoms, and it can sound, I mean, it sounds dry and it sounds, right?
You can detach from it. But when you go through it, you're like, oh, wow, that's why people end up going to the ER before they end up coming to a psychologist. Because
yes,
they really do feel like they're going to die.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's just so powerful.
And that's why it's so hard sometimes to follow through on the activities you might have planned with them to do between sessions. Because when you're in the grip of it, it is really hard to face something that's triggering panic.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, some of the more complicated cases that I've had of panic is when there actually is a comorbid medical condition, whether it be GERD or whether it be an actual heart condition that's diagnosed in addition to the panic attacks. Those are, I found them to be a bit more difficult to treat, just because we can't automatically dismiss the catastrophic thought. We have to actually, to a degree, acknowledge that, you know, there is a medical condition that's present. So that's been a little bit more of a challenge. But also when, actually I've noticed when I have certain patients that have the choking sensation as part of their panic, that's been a bit more challenging, as well. You know, especially if it's like drinking water while you're driving and, you know, experiencing that choking sensation and then swerving. I've had some of those more tricky situations. So,
Yes. I mean, do you have an hypothesis about why it may be more difficult for those people to get a lot out of the treatment?
You know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about that, but it's funny because they consistently say that they wish that they had the racing heartbeat, or they wish that they had the trembling hands, or they wish that they got lightheaded. They wish they had any other symptom other than the choking sensation. So I maybe because the swallowing is so common, it's just like a, you know, I had one patient who had to chew her food for like 5 minutes before she could swallow because of that choking sensation, that choking response. So maybe that sort of taps into it, but it's a really good question.
Yes, but interesting. It sounds like it's fairly consistent in your experience that individuals with that particular symptom have a harder time making progress in the treatment, because it makes me think, and this may be a different issue, but many people that I've treated, most often with OCD, with obsessive compulsive disorder, will compare their type of OCD to other types and wish they had a type that's not theirs.
Exactly.
Right. And it doesn't seem to correspond to the type. I mean, it may be two people with different kinds of OCD, and each could be wishing they had the other person's type.
Yep.
Which I suspect might be partly that it's just for any of us, it's hard to understand that what another person is deathly afraid of is just as scary to them as the thing that we're deathly afraid of, that they may not fear at all.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I came down on the end of the day, that we just continue to treat the symptom. We continue to acknowledge that it is a symptom. It's a byproduct of the disorder. And we just continue with the protocol. And by and large, there's been tremendous success, and even without the use of medications. And that really speaks to some of the some of the techniques and empirically supported principles that I learned over at CTSA. Mm.
It sounds like what you're providing really is the best I can imagine for cognitive behavioral therapy for CBT. I think CBT can it can have a reputation of being hard to describe exactly.
I've heard it described as cookbook.
Totally.
Cold, detached.
Yes.
My approach to that is that I really, first I just want to say the verdict is out on so many conditions. You know, like the research is overwhelming. So, you know, if I have somebody with a panic attack, if I have somebody with OCD, to not use some elements of cognitive behavioral therapy, I don't want to speak too strongly, but I'll say it's definitely what I would use. it's definitely the approach that I would use to certain conditions because we just know that it works. And I think to a certain degree, you just as a clinician, you should have some sort of an ethical obligation to do what works. So even if you're not going to do CBT or some form of exposure therapy, you definitely want to follow something even loosely that's associated with some empirically supported practice. So, you know, what I try to do is use that as the framework when I'm treating a patient. So, you know, I know what works. I know that there's going to be some elements of exposure, increasing the tolerance to the anxiety, some sort of behavioral techniques, some sort of relaxation techniques. I spend a lot of time getting patients or training patients to breathe in a healthy way. A lot of my patients think they know how to breathe. And I usually start off by saying most people don't breathe in a healthy way. And that's when I introduce diaphragmatic breathing. So I spend a lot of time on education. And then I really try to mix in the joining and connecting and really just explaining to patients that, you know, these are not such foreign conditions. You're not a damaged, broken person. These are common conditions, and for the vast majority of patients that I see, one of the more frequent things that I say is, if I went through everything that you went through, I would probably be showing the same symptoms.
Yes.
You're not crazy. These are normal reactions to abnormal circumstances. So that's really, and I don't just say that as a line. I say that because I firmly believe it. And I think that when patients start to understand that, then it sort of takes the mystique out of therapy and out of psychology, and people don't think that they're these terrible case studies to be worked on by, you know, a team of professionals and things of that nature.
You know, somebody that I treated a while back said that he thinks that what most people who come for therapy want to hear is that they're not crazy. And to the point that you're making, it seems like a lot of times that the response that a person is having to conditions that are unbearable is an extremely sane response to have, even though it feels crazy to the person.
Absolutely. It feels so foreign. And people very frequently keep their distress to themselves. So then they continue to have these thoughts of, I'm crazy, something's wrong with me, and that fuels an emotion like depression or self-loathing, and that might fuel some other negative behavior. But then they have this sort of closed feedback loop where they just kind of continue to escalate with these intense negative thoughts and this intense negative self-talk, to the extent where, you know, I treated patients who've been doing that sort of negative loop for decades. Mm. And by the time that they met with me and they just finally start to process and speak some of those thoughts and just hear it challenged by myself. And a lot of times it doesn't even need to be challenged. Sometimes by the time someone says something, they recognize themselves that this sounds off. that this thought doesn't really make too much sense. So that's the one of the techniques that I use when I'm working with different patients. I try to normalize the condition, and don't get me wrong, when there's some behaviors or conditions that are, you know, well outside, you know, the norm of rational, you know, I always give patients my honest opinion, and sometimes it leads to an uncomfortable conversation. But I tell them straight up, I say, you know, you'll always know what I'm thinking, because, you know, I'll tell you, and you know, you don't have to follow my recommendations or my opinions, but I'll always give them to you. And that's why you came to see me. So,
and that difficult conversation definitely beats the alternative. And I think it's what people often come to appreciate is exactly what you said, finding a place and a person where they know they'll find honesty.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I wanted to go back with you for a second, and you mentioned proper breathing technique, and this is something that applies certainly in panic and other anxiety conditions, and I think for good stress management in general. Can you say more, kind of walk us through, you know, for people who may not be familiar with what diaphragmatic breathing is?
Sure. So usually I'll ask someone who's particularly anxious, I'll say, can you show me what it looks like when you take a deep breath? And usually, like 9 times out of 10, they take this huge gasp of air, their chest heaves up into the air, their shoulders go way back, and then like they exhale really big, and they just seem so exasperated afterwards.
Yes.
So that's when I say, well, actually, what we look at as healthy breathing is going to come from your belly. So I usually get them to put their hand on their belly, try to push that belly out, push that hand out while they inhale, which is really awkward. And I let them know. I say, you know, this is going to be awkward. And I try to demonstrate it with them. And I usually get people to breathe in for about 3 seconds, hold that for 3 seconds, breathe out for 3 seconds, and then hold that. So I usually try to encourage them to pause in between the inhale and the exhale, but really try to push that belly out as they inhale, and then pull the belly in as they exhale. So most patients have never even heard of that, and they look at me like I'm a Martian. If someone's particularly anxious and kind of insecure about doing that when they're in session, I won't really push it. But what I try to do is get that nice corrective experience in the appointment. So what I try to do is do like a really quick rating scale before we engage with the activity. So I'll say, so like right now, because a lot of times people are anxious the first time they come in to see a psychologist. So they're kind of trying to figure me out, you know, throughout the entire initial part of the appointment. So I'll say, you know, what's your anxiety? And they might say like, I'm at like a 6 or a 7. I've never done this before. I'm talking about really personal issues. And then what we'll do is we'll do the exercise. And usually I don't do it for any more than about 60 to 90 seconds. Then after we finish, if someone was really able to connect with it, they'll say, all right, well, my anxiety went down. So it's about like a 4 out of 10. And I try to give anchor points when I introduce it. So I'll say like 0 is you're on a beach somewhere in Tahiti relaxing in the sun. A 10 would be so crippling that you couldn't even get out of bed. You're just like crippled, riddled with anxiety. Just to give them kind of a framework and some anchor points. So in most cases, patients say that they have experienced a reduction in their anxiety just after about 60 seconds of doing like a breathing exercise. And the reason I always go to breathing is because, you know, I look at it as sort of twofold. So the first is, you're actually deactivating that fight or flight response by practicing healthy breathing. So you're not doing the type of hyperventilating breathing, the rapid shallow breathing that's up through your chest, but you're doing slower breathing. You're slowing your breathing down, and you're doing it from the right place. You're doing it from that diaphragm. So you're actually getting more oxygen into your system. You're telling your body that you're not in a state of panic. There's nothing to panic right now. You're in a safe place. You're in the psychologist's office. Second reason why it's so important is because you're actually focusing your attention on your breathing. And that's what I try to teach patients. Like even in that first encounter, I say, when you're thinking about your divorce, or you're thinking about your kids having problems in school. Like, all those thoughts create, they directly influence your emotions. So when you're focusing on your breathing, you're not thinking about all the stresses of your life. You're thinking about your breathing, getting it right, pushing that air through your belly, holding it, you know, releasing it, that whole process. And that's a great introduction into mindfulness. So that's why I usually encourage nice diaphragmatic breathing and just starting off slow. So doing it every day, like maybe two or three times a day, just for like a couple minutes, just to get some mindfulness and also train your body how to breathe in a nice, healthy way. The vast majority of my patients really appreciate the breathing.
It's pretty striking what even a minute or two of relaxed breathing can do, isn't it? It's like a direct dial right into our nervous system.
Absolutely.
And I guess the same is true on the other end. If you have someone, I'll sometimes demonstrate, ask a person to hyperventilate with me for a few breath cycles, you know, breathe as quickly, deeply, yeah, and rapidly as possible. And it's, I mean,
yeah, the interoceptive exposure, right?
Yes. And it's aversive. It is not a pleasant experience.
You are so right. And you know what? I no longer do it. Because I had an experience where a patient was like, I don't like this.
Yes.
it got a little messy. So I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. We're just going to do the the relaxation part. Maybe I didn't lay out the framework enough about the rationale behind it. But
Well, you know, along those lines, have you ever have someone who has a paradoxical response to the relaxed breathing actually finds that it induces anxiety?
Yeah, and those are typically the patients that they've been experiencing anxiety so frequently that it's so difficult for them to actually disconnect from it. It's difficult for them to have a moment where they actually try to clear their mind and they can just focus on something calm. They're usually the people who end up having to fill their time with work, with tasks, with jobs. They are usually the people that need to fill their plate in order to avoid the experience of worry thoughts or pleasant emotions. So a lot of, it does happen sometimes when, you know, I try to engage a patient and it's just too hard in that appointment. And in those cases, I say it's perfectly fine. You know, what we're trying to do is a new skill. And it might take some time, you know, when we're talking about changing something that you've been doing for decades in some cases. So, you know, I just encourage them to go home, try to practice it, be, you know, by yourself, you know, while you're driving, you know, whenever you'd like to do it. Just practice it and then follow up with me.
So for someone who is using consciously or unconsciously, is using a lot of thinking and doing to block out certain experiences, certain unpleasant thoughts or feelings, really slowing those things down through focused breathing might expose them to them and increase anxiety. Is that what you're describing?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
You know, I also try to frame for people that the point of the breathing, and this fits with what you were saying about shifting our focus, it's not... It often has the very pleasant effect of reducing our anxiety, but if we approach it as, okay, I'm going to do this thing and it better reduce my anxiety, then it can turn into a kind of, is it working? I'm doing the breathing. Oh no, it's not working. Now what?
Yeah, which is, it's so funny that you say that because it sounds like you're experiencing the same thing that I experience, which invariably, and I really... Seth, I try to lay out the rationale really, really clearly. And a lot of times I even write it out and give it to patients for the homework assignment of trying the breathing every day just for a couple minutes. And I usually emphasize, do it when you're not anxious. Mm. For some reason, no one ever hears that. So when patients come back, they say, yeah, you know, I did it like three times because I got really stressed out and, you know, yeah, it worked, or no, it wasn't so helpful or whatever. So, you know, that's when I just sort of gently remind them that what we're talking about is breathing retraining. So you really want to get into the habit of breathing in a healthy way, just naturally, so we can lower that resting place for anxiety, that physiological experience of anxiety in your body. And once you really get the hang of it, then you can do it all the time. You can, I mean, if something's really triggering you, or if you find that you're in a panic attack, yeah, you know, go ahead, kick it in. But you don't want to just do it when you're at those highest points of anxiety, because you don't want to train your body that this is what happens when you're experiencing the worst anxiety. So, you know, sometimes that requires a little bit more training. But, you know, what I found is usually when the patients have the motivation to keep coming back, those are the patients that make the progress. Because, you know, sometimes you need a little bit more feedback. You need a little bit more correction. Sometimes maybe I said a word wrong and a patient sort of misconstrued it. Maybe there was some miscommunication in some other ways. But I found consistently when patients keep coming back and they're focused on getting their needs met, I go above and beyond to make sure that I can do whatever I can to make sure they get their needs met. And even if I can't, then that's why that's when I try to identify who can, and try to get them to someone who can actually reduce their symptoms.
And you mentioned a little bit ago the concept of mindfulness, which is something that I address a lot in the work that I do and that I enjoy as a practice in my own life. And it's something that has really made its way into cognitive behavioral therapy. How much is that something that you incorporate into your own practice?
Oh, I mean, it's so powerful, and I try to embrace it and pretty much every way that I can. I think mindfulness sometimes gets like a bad rap. I have patients that think that it's kind of like, you have to do yoga in order to be mindful, or you have to do, I don't know, fill in the blank of whatever activity, that they kind of like restrict it. So a lot of times what I'm re-educating patients is like, mindfulness is your diaphragmatic breathing. Mindfulness is your walking to the park. Mindfulness is your playing basketball. It's just getting out of that future worry, catastrophic thoughts, getting out of the past depressive thoughts. It's just finding a way to connect with the present moment, however you do it. I used to have a little sand rock garden in my office, and patients would love to come in and like play with the sand and move the rocks around. And then I would tell them that the sand is supposed to represent the water and the rocks are supposed to represent mountains. And then I'd be a little silly with them sometimes, and I would tell them that I'm learning about their personality by the strokes in the sand that they're making. I'd tell them I was just joking. But I would let them know, like, this is mindfulness, you know, just focusing on the sand, just moving the rocks around, you know, just being involved in this present moment. And what we find so consistently is that when people are able to connect with the present moment, it reduces anxiety, it reduces depression, it reduces stress, as long as they're in a safe situation. So that's what I try to incorporate into really every element of my treatment.
Now, where did you learn about mindfulness?
You know, I learned about it through my doctoral program. So, you know, I did various externships. You know, we talked about it at Penn, but, you know, we talked about it in our classes at PCOM really frequently. I was present for trainings on mindfulness, and, that's when I was first introduced to the concepts. It was really throughout the course of training at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Mm.
Now, I know you did your doctoral training there, and you did a master's before that. Is that right?
Yes,
down in Kentucky,
Louisville, Kentucky.
In Louisville, yeah. What took you to Louisville?
You said it pretty nicely, Seth.
Well, you know, my grandparents are from Kentucky, and I actually lived in eastern Kentucky for 2 years when I was a little kid.
Oh, okay. My roommate was he was from eastern Kentucky. There's a little bit of a rivalry between Eastern Kentucky and Western Kentucky.
Well,
when it comes
yeah.
to basketball, at least.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Right. Between Lexington and Louisville. Is that right?
Yeah,
UK and
yeah,
Louisville.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So it's funny that Lexington's considered, I think of that as Western Texas, but obviously it's, sorry, Western Kentucky. Obviously it's it's far east of Louisville. We were about, I think, a couple hours east of Lexington.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I knew that you had some sort of connection because you said it pretty nicely. You said Louisville. I mean, it took me a few months to get it down packed, and I didn't know what they were talking about. I was like, why is this not Louisville?
is that what I was trying to think? What people who aren't from the area, what they say, Louisville?
Louisville. But yeah, after a few months, I got it down packed. But yeah, it was a great experience down there. I got my master's, my first master's in clinical psychology down in Spalding University.
So Spalding, that's right.
Yeah, Spalding University. It's a small Catholic school down there in the heart of Louisville.
And then I assume you got a second master's on the way to your doctorate.
Yes.
At PCOM?
Yes, that was when I earned my master's in science.
Now, did you know that you, when you went to Spalding, did you know you were en route to a doctorate, or were you thinking that might be a terminal master's?
Yeah, so what happened was I got down there, and that was my first experience being away from my family. Now, I grew up as like a, I don't know, I was a home, kind of like a homebody, maybe like a sheltered kid. So when I actually decided that I was going to move, and, you know, that was a large move for me. I mean, Louisville is probably about, I think it was like an 11-hour drive.
Where were you? Where was your family? Where'd you grow up?
So we grew up in Delaware.
Wilmington,
Delaware. And I went to undergraduate at the University of Delaware. So that was about 20 minutes from where I grew up, from my parents' house. So when I graduated from University of Delaware and decided that I was going to move to Kentucky, I was like, whoa, this is going to be fun. It's going to be different. Finally, I get a chance to be off on my own and, you know, live life the way I want to do it and make my own rules and all this stuff. And I got there, and the program was actually supposed to be a 3-year master's degree. And after the first year, I said, what do I need to do to make this finished in 2 years?
Okay.
So I actually loaded up on all my courses and all my practicum, and I actually shaved off an entire year and ended up finishing that in 2 years because I got so incredibly homesick.
Oh, my goodness. You were super motivated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it was so bad that if I had a 3-day weekend, I would just drive the 11 hours and just go back home.
Wow. For a 3-day weekend.
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually another way that I connect with my patients because, you know, I say, like, if you're ever far from home, you know, I used to do some work in a prison. And I'd say, you know, like, what helped me out was it's not Thanksgiving. It's just Thursday. So you can just you can just get a sandwich and keep on moving. You know? That was the way I got through some of those holidays that were really rough. But yeah, overall, it was a great experience down there. I learned so much. It was really interesting because I learned about therapy. It was my first experience learning about psychological testing and theory and therapy and how to approach patients. So that's kind of like the foundation. And then when I went up to Philadelphia and studied at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, their approach was a bit different. It was a bit more emphasizing of cognitive behavioral therapy. So, and at Spalding, they pretty much identified, like, hey, you choose what kind of approach that you'd like, you know, whether it be interpersonal, whether it be psychodynamic, whether it be CBT, eclectic, you know, so I learned about all these different approaches, you know, Alfred Adler and, you know, all the Neo-Freudians, but there was more of a push for the CBT once I got up to Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. I mean, obviously, they're like right across the street from the Beck Institute, right? And just that Philadelphia region is really a hotbed of CBT. So obviously, there's a little bit more of an emphasis on that type of treatment. So it was really cool, a unique experience for me. And I think that that's kind of guided the way that I treat patients because coming from that initial point of what I learned at Spalding, and then taking and incorporating the knowledge that I have of the empirically supported treatments of CBT and the like, and just sort of combining all that together a lot of times is what helps me to figure out how to best join with a patient, and also provide them with empirically supported treatments.
Now, did you also study psychology as an undergrad at Delaware?
Yes. Yep.
So do you? All right. So do you? And I'm asking this as someone who, for whatever reason, I never took any psychology as an undergrad, and I came to it later. What drew you to psychology? What brought you to the field?
So, originally, I was actually going to be a lawyer, and I took a pre-med class. Not a pre-med. I took a trial practice law course, and we essentially had these sheets of information that kind of presented this mock case, and I realized, as I was going through these sheets, that I really wasn't looking for the truth as much as I was looking for a way to sort of present my argument and present my side. And for whatever reason, I just took that one experience and I was like, you know what? Maybe this whole law thing isn't for me, because I really want to get to what is the truth, what is the heart of how to help people. I've always wanted to help people. I've always gotten so much pleasure out of knowing that I was the agent of change for someone getting better. So I said, how can I get involved in helping people? How can I do some sort of a therapy? So then I started thinking about what kind of therapies are there, and what can I do? And I just thought about psychology. And I remember as an undergrad, I ended up choosing my major for psychology. And I was thinking, well, this is going to be pretty cool. I'll just be a psychologist. So as soon as I graduate, I'll just go out and I'll be a psychologist.
Boom, done.
And at some point during that freshman year, I ended up looking at some course, some sort of a course description or course catalog or something, and some other information. And it kind of spelled out the track that you need to go for in order to actually become a licensed clinical psychologist. And I was immediately deflated.
Oh.
And not just deflated. I thought this is kind of funny because I'm doing this major, but I'll never actually be a psychologist. So I don't really know what I'm going to do, but it's not going to be psychology.
Right.
Yeah. And I experienced that sort of imposter syndrome throughout my master's degree. Throughout my first master's degree and up until, I would say, probably the first year, maybe into the second year of my doctoral program, just that sense of everybody else here is pretty smart. I don't know how I got here.
Huh.
So it actually, it was kind of eye opening, because once we got to talking and you make your connections with your colleagues, you realize that most everybody has that same feeling too. They all kind of look around and they're all kind of, oh, wow, everybody else is pretty smart.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's a striking thing, isn't it? How common that feeling is, that everyone else is smarter than I am.
Yeah.
Sort of the reverse Lake Wobegon thing. Everyone thinks they're below average.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, from just about every conversation I would have with you, I mean, it was like a running joke where I would say, Seth, you're not quite a human. I don't know what you are, but you're not 100% human. I mean, you write books, you write articles, you got this podcast series going on. I mean, you're always doing some amazing stuff. So, you're one of those people that fueled my imposter syndrome.
Oh no. Well, very, very kind of you to say. I certainly an unintended side effect.
No, I kid, but actually I look at it as really inspiring. Having my own private practice, being a psychologist, these are all things that I only dreamed that I'd be able to do. And now that I'm doing them, I'm looking to see how can I continue to grow. Looking at people like you and seeing what you're doing in the field, writing books and just being creative with the way that you're disseminating information and keeping relevant and keeping current. All that stuff is really inspiring. That's why I was just so happy that you thought about me to participate in this podcast.
So kind of you to say, but I have to tell you, Jason, for full disclosure, when I was catching up with you and seeing what you've been up to, I was inspired by, I mean, it looks like you're just really going for it in terms of, I mean, you've got two offices, you have, at least a couple people working for you.
Yeah. I have a psychologist and an art therapist.
Yes.
Providing treatment. Yes.
Yes. And you have multiple things going on in your practice that we're going to talk more about in a little bit. So, So I gotta hand it back to you that you're also inspiring me, just seeing, wow, you're really, really making things happen.
Oh, cool, man. That's really, that means a lot coming from you. Thank you.
Oh my goodness. And I'm sure that this is not, that your life is not, you don't have a ton of time on your hands, I'm guessing. You got other things going on.
So, you know, that's an interesting question. So, when you have your own practice, you can create a ton of time, and less will get done. or you can sort of go to the other extreme and sort of have no time, and you're sort of burning down the road and moving at 100, and a whole lot of stuff's getting done, but it's not the best quality. So what I'm trying to do is figure out the right balance of self-care and connection with my company, with my family, with myself as a man. It's a challenge, and it's a constant struggle that I'm always paying attention to. I'm speaking to colleagues regularly about how to maintain a good balance and how to remain fulfilled, while at the same time maximizing my productivity and minimizing my cost. So yeah, it's an ongoing struggle.
And you mentioned family. You have kids?
Yeah. I got a couple kids, and I got a wife, and we just got a new puppy. So that's one of the things that I'm using to try to balance myself.
Oh wow! And how old are your kids?
7 and 4.
Seven. So your older one was born when you were at CTSA, is that right? Or had been born by then?
So my older one was born in 2010. So yeah, she was around for when I was at CTSA.
Yeah, I have a memory of meeting. So and your daughter.
Oh, that's right.
Oh,
that was
party?
Such a funny. Yeah, that was the funniest story. That's when Dr. Foa's dog ended up biting my daughter's hand.
Oh,
but it wasn't serious. It was, she had a brand new puppy, and you know, puppies.
Yes,
nip.
Yes.
That's actually what we're going through right now. Our puppy's nipping at us and doing all this stuff. It was just so hilarious because she had this, this brand new puppy, and I had this brand new little girl, and her puppy's name was my first name.
That's
so
right.
She named her puppy Jason. So the whole time that we were there, she's yelling to this puppy to stop it.
I remember that.
Because the puppy kept like picking stuff up and like chewing on stuff. So she would always say, drop it. So she would say, drop it, Jason. And I would always turn around because I'm like, what is that Nafoa yelling at me for?
Right.
I'm like looking around at Dr. Foa, and she's looking at a puppy, and
I remember that. It was so funny. She was, stop it, Jason. Stop that.
Right. Drop it.
I'm just holding my baby.
Right. Yeah, that was a good time. I forgot. Does she still have those pool parties?
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't. My guess is yes. But I don't know. So you've got plenty going on. You've got obviously being involved as a dad is a huge commitment in terms of time and energy. What do you do to, I mean, I found for myself that self-care was such an important thing for everyone else to be doing, and for me to give lip service to.
And, so, man.
Right. And so what's your experience been with self-care, and what do you do to keep yourself balanced and to sustain yourself?
Well, I'm so glad you brought it up, because you're right. And I think very frequently what we do is we kind of give lip service to it, and we say, yeah, you know, self-care is important for everyone else, but you know, for us, you know, we have a job to do. Like we got to do something that's a little bit different. But what I'm realizing more and more as I get out of school, as I have some more distance between, you know, my doctoral program and my work career, is that I need to create that self-care. And if I don't, no one will, because no one can understand me best. So part of what I try to do is just weave it into my day. So I weave in going to the gym and exercising. I weave in strength training and cardio. I try to maintain a healthy diet, and that's probably the part that's lagging the most, because I'm a guy that likes like bacon cheeseburgers. So, you know, today I had a Cobb salad, you know, so every little bit I just try to make those small changes and, you know, get my wife on board and, you know, get the kids on board, because all they want to do is eat mac and cheese and chicken nuggets. So,
of course.
but exercise is one thing that I do to stay on the self-care train. I think, you know, vacationing obviously is going to be really important. You know, it's the summer months. You know, I would say a large part of what I do that I've virtually always done, except for, you know, during the dissertation years, when you're writing your dissertation, you just give up your life. Just, mm-hmm. I mean, there's no self-care to happen during that time. But outside of that, I never work on the weekends. I never do any type of work, for anything. So that's pretty much been consistent. I try not to work too late. You know, I try to, you know, once I'm finished with work, you know, whether that be, you know, one of my offices, I finished running groups at about 8:30 at night. So, I mean, obviously that's going to be pretty mm-hmm. late, but you know, what I try to do is kind of disconnect when I get back home, try to do things that sort of reconnect me with myself. And, you know, having a dog, you know, they just love to be loved. You know, they love to be petted, and you know, that's kind of fun, and that's mindfulness for me to just kind of reconnect with my puppy. And you know, if my kids are around, you know, last week I just took my daughter on a really nice walk, and we just talked about her friends and what she likes to do. So I'm trying to find ways to connect with my family, and really just sort of maximize on the good things that are happening. You know, I think there's a trend to be so focused on the future and be so focused on creating and developing, and while I'm still doing that, I'm networking, I'm working on ways to build the company, and I got a lot of irons in the fire. But if I'm not still trying to remain grounded in some way and putting really just as much energy into that self-care piece, I know things will spiral out of control, and I won't really have a good quality of life. And I think ultimately that's what we're aiming for. You know, we want the success, and, you know, we want the thriving practice. You want the money, you want, you know, all those positive things that come with success. But if you don't have that quality of life where you actually look forward to waking up in the morning, you don't dread your day, you know, I think that's at least the goal for me.
Well, I certainly commend you for prioritizing those things. Self-care seems to be one of those activities or one of the things we might do that is so hard to do unless we have to. You know, we're compelled by need, and it makes me think of, we were talking earlier about people mostly practicing relaxed breathing when they're really feeling anxious and feeling like, oh my God, I need some way to relax. And it's harder to practice something when we don't need it, to do it just because we know it's in the long run a good thing to do for ourselves. And it's much easier to be reactive, to change our diet when we have some kind of health crisis, to start finding time for ourselves once we're well into burnout.
Yeah. What's that expression? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Yes.
Right. I think you're so right. And that's actually where I am with when it comes to self-care. I would say I've not been as kind to myself as I could have been through moving at the pace that I have been moving at to achieve success. It's been a very core value for me for the past 10, actually about the past 15 years, success. And I think everyone defines it differently. But I've defined it as academic achievement and professional growth. Just fiercely, to the best of my abilities, focusing on, ways to grow, ways to develop a practice. So I've been pushing that for such a long time that one of the things I'm trying to do now is figure out, all right, well, I can do these things, I can do these things at a high level. But I don't want to do these things at a high level and then find myself in an early grave. I want to do these things at a high level and enjoy my life, and help other people to do these things at a high level. So that's for me why it's so important, to make sure that I do focus on that ounce of prevention, and that I try to find a way to weave it into every day. And really, exercise has been tremendous for me. I really try to exercise, whenever I can, usually in the middle of a work day. I'll try to take a break, and instead of eating lunch, I'll just go to the gym, and then I'll try to weave in the lunch at some point, like while I'm getting back to work. But I think structure, trying to get up, trying to have like a certain routine for your day. I look at that as self-care, knowing when to disconnect from work and to connect with those things, those other elements of your life that give you value, are so incredibly important. I wish I could be a bit more of a guru on how to provide self-care, but it's an area. I mean, I still consider myself an early career psychologist. So, I'm still learning. I'm still talking to colleagues. I'm still trying to figure out some stuff myself.
Mm. And one issue that seems to come up for a lot of us, especially if we know people are counting on us, is a certain fear of failing, a fear of not succeeding professionally, not succeeding financially, and maybe not driven by a desire for more, but just not wanting to fall on our faces.
Yeah. Well, for me, that fear is, it's always there. It's always been there. And I think one of the aspects about my personality that's helped me, has been my ability to face things that are, fearful. And just do it anyway. I mean, to be quite honest with you, I've never done a podcast before. So, this whole concept was fear provoking, and anxiety provoking, but then I thought, all right, well, I'll just do it.
Awesome.
So, and I obviously I don't do that with everything. I'm still not skydiving ever. but for things that I think actually might add some value to my life, and might help me with growth, the same way I tell my patients, let's try to practice it. Let's try to get out there and get out of our comfort zone sometimes. That's what I try to do. So, go ahead.
Yes. And trying to do for ourselves those things that we ask other people to do. It seems like one of the issues that might come up for people in the mental health field is that we have these tools for addressing our thoughts, for planning actions that help move us toward our goals, for practicing presence and stress reduction. And I think of those, I think of two main ways that we can manage our stress. One is on that side. It's on how we think, how we arrange our days, practicing mindfulness and relaxation techniques, kind of ways of dealing with what's going on in our lives. And then we've got the other side, which is just what our lives look like how busy we are, for example. Yeah. So you can imagine two people who have exactly the same number of commitments in a day. One might go through it kind of mindlessly, just sort of slogging through, feeling miserable. Another person who might go through finding small ways in the course of the day to manage stress, keep moving, not be overwhelmed. And I know, at least for myself, it was easy to focus on that first part, focus on I'm just going to find ways of dealing with everything I have going on, and ignoring the fact that at some point there is a limit. I think there's a point at which no matter what we might do, no matter what we might know to use to deal with all that's going on in our lives, we're just going to get overwhelmed if, for example, we're constantly working, we're never taking a break. I don't know if you found anything similar for yourself.
Yeah, it's definitely what I've found. And it's the reason why I say this to patients, that what we find when we look at the research, and even through anecdotal examples, when you take breaks and when you care for yourself, you're actually better at doing whatever the job is that you're trying to do. So working 7 days a week and working 12, 15 hours a day, you actually do a better job if you take a break, take a vacation, you know, take a day off. When you get back to it, you feel reconnected and you feel more like yourself. And I experienced this when I took a vacation and went down to the beach and got a chance to just kind of clear my mind.
Yes. You know? It does. Makes a huge difference. There's the experience itself. There's having had that break. And there's also knowing the break is coming. Thank God.
Yeah, I'm actually working on my vacation now. This ironically, this was going to be the last day of my vacation week, and I thought, no, I got all this stuff going on with my practice, and I got to work on these offices, and if I don't do this stuff, who's going to do it? And I got all these irons in the fire, and so I was actually thinking about just skipping my vacation altogether, and I was like, come on, Jason, what are you doing? This is exactly what you tell patients every single day. So you can't just forgo your vacation for the summer, because and really, I say that because I know how it affected me when I've done it in the past. I know that I'm better at my job when I have a break. Yes. I know that I'm, you know, better able to reconnect with my patients and help guide them to health. So, and it's just great for me. It's great for me to reconnect with my family and sort of get out of the daily routine of like, did you do your homework and all that kind of stuff? But you actually kind of reconnect and figure out who these people are that you're spending your time with all the time.
And I'm guessing your family would have had something to say about skipping vacation.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, if it weren't for my wife, I probably would not have started taking regular summer vacations. And
really?
It makes no sense. But once you're self-employed and you realize, like, oh, like no one's going to be paying me when I take that time off.
Yeah.
And when you're just starting out, it's a scary prospect. And I was saying yes to everything, working. I was teaching full time. I was having full time practice. I was seeing people through video conference in the evenings. I was working half of every Saturday, and it was just too much. It was not sustainable.
Yeah. I don't even know. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you do half the stuff that you do, but yeah, I mean, I totally empathize.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Well, my brother asked me when I was telling him, like, oh, but it's, you know, it's so much money to go on vacation and there's no income coming in during that time. And he said, well, what would you rather have? You know, and he proposed, you know, if I had two job offers and one was, you know, a bit more money and no vacation time, or job B, less money, 2 weeks vacation. It's like, well, obviously I'm not going to take a job with no vacation. He's like, well, there you go. That's your situation.
There you go. sounds like your brother's using some techniques on you.
Yes.
Effective.
It's good to have good brothers. I tell you that the vacation is not only a break, but it's also time in your life that you remember.
Yeah, you're so right. You know, my family, we went to Jamaica last year, and you know, my kids, it's so funny. They just kind of come home from school and they say, can we go to Jamaica again? they're always about, and then they'll never forget it. They made these great memories, and it was a really, really special time. So, I mean, obviously we're not going to be able to do that every year, but I think, you know, a trip down to the shore, you know, some sort of an excursion that we can get into. Actually, having this conversation with you, I'm thinking, you know, we should go ahead and put the deposit down today.
Absolutely. Yes, you definitely should. I can't count the number of times that I've planned a vacation and thought, well, you know, we'll go for 4 days or something, or go for 2 days, you know, go for Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, so I can still work. I can basically work a full week, Monday to Wednesday, and then Wednesday to Friday.
Yeah.
And then when the time comes and I'm needing that time off, and I think, what was I doing? Like why did historical me do this to me?
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a really interesting concept. I was talking to a psychologist, and she talked about the am I being kind to myself, and what's the relationship that I have with myself? And it was kind of eye opening, because, you know, I'm thinking, like, I might be upset if somebody else treated me like this.
Absolutely.
I might have some problems with
who would do this to me.
Right. So am I really embracing it? Am I the embodiment of that concept of being kind to yourself?
Yeah, I often think it's kind of bad luck for us that we're born into our own selves, because we're just not very nice to ourselves. Right? And we're the person. I mean, you were alluding to this earlier about self-care, that nobody is going to be – nobody knows exactly what you need, and no one's going to be demanding that you take – the care of yourself that you need. And so we have this unique opportunity that often so many of us use for abuse rather than for care.
Yeah. And it's kind of strange, because, you know, when we're in school, it's hard, because, you know, you're in these rigorous programs, and they're obligated to train you, you know, and they have a heavy burden, because they're going to be turning you out to the community. And they got to make sure that you're not going to be some reckless, unethical person. And they got to make sure that you have the knowledge and the skills and the expertise in order to go forth and heal. So they got this tremendous burden. But as a student, you're just sort of like inundated with all this stuff. Like, you got to do these papers, and you got to do the tests, and you got to show up for class, and you got to do comps and dissertation and research, and I did an independent study. And you're doing all this stuff, and you're trying to look good for internship sites, and you're just racking your brain trying to do all this stuff, and then you actually like achieve some success, but it's kind of based on you kind of forgoing your own self-care a lot of times.
Yes.
So, you know, it's a sort of, I've looked at it as kind of like an unusual dynamic, because to a certain degree, you kind of, to achieve certain goals and to do certain things in life, it almost seems like you have to a degree, just know that for a time, self-care is going to have to be adjusted a bit. I guess that's the nicest way that I could phrase it. You know, I wouldn't say you forgo it all away, but, you know, I know there were certain times when, you know, it's a Friday night and that dissertation has all those edits on it and it's staring at me, and I'm just thinking, I don't want to do this, but I kind of need to get this done. And it was like Saturday and Sunday mm-hmm. and Monday. And then that was on top of all the other commitments that you have. So, you know, it's strange, because you're incentivized to forgo yourself. And then once you achieve a certain level, then you kind of look around and you're like, well, I need to find some new incentives and some new ways to be productive. So
that's a really important point about finding that balance in self-care, because I think this idea of you need to take care of yourself can become a should, that then if we are in an extra busy time in our lives, we can just make it one more thing to feel bad about. Like, oh, I should be meditating. I should be exercising. I should be taking more time to cook yeah. wholesome food. Rather than saying part of self-care and self-kindness at this point, being friendly toward myself, might be saying, you know what, you're going through a difficult time. Let's regroup when things slow down a little.
That's exactly – I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, just having that self-talk where you say, you know, this is a tough time, and I think anybody would feel upset during this time. It's funny, like saying this to you right now is really like the sort of model that I go through while I'm talking to patients.
Yes.
You know, a lot of times I just kind of – because I believe it.
Exactly.
But I think sometimes it's important to just remind yourself what you believe, because sometimes we're just so involved in all the different things and activities and whatnot that we don't take a second to remind ourselves that this is just a rough time and we'll get through it.
I want to ask you about a related point. We're talking about self-care, and we were talking self-care and also the way that we talk to ourselves, and we discussed a little before this feeling of the imposter syndrome, and how I'm interested in your take on this, because I'm often perplexed by how negative we can be toward ourselves for no good reason. And I don't just mean the kind of obviously distorted beliefs in depressive type thinking, for example, but just a kind of seeing ourselves as, well, for example, if your doppelganger had been in your program, there'd been another Jason Hunt,
right,
who was like you in virtually every way, but just not you. You didn't live in this person's skin. How do you think you would have? And this may be difficult to do. Or awkward to say, but how would you have felt about that? What would you have thought about that person? Would you have thought like, oh, at least there's someone else who doesn't belong here? Or would you have thought something?
right.
But what would you have thought?
You know, that's funny that you asked that, because it's kind of like looking at yourself in the third person. And I think it's actually a pretty cool technique, because I wouldn't think those same insecurities. I would think this person seems thoughtful in their speech, seems to be bright. So I would probably immediately go to those positive. And I think that's just kind of naturally what I do. Like, people even make fun of me because, you know, it could be some of the most disagreeable people, but I kind of tend to find what are those best elements, and then I kind of connect with those best elements, and I can have a conversation with just about anybody. So I think I would automatically start to look for those more positive attributes. But I think going back to myself and why it's easier for me to think about those the imposter syndrome and those negative attributes is, I think there's some utility in that. I think there's something about focusing on negatives where I focus on how I can improve that. And ultimately it's something where there's some utility in doing it a little bit, and sort of acknowledging hey, here's an area for growth. Hey, here's something that I can work on. Versus, oh, I am so crappy at this. I am the worst at that. So, you know, what I try to do is like adjust the language a little bit. So when I recognize that I'm saying like, oh, you're so stupid. What are you doing? To recognize, well, wait a minute. You're not stupid. You might not be the best, or you might not be perfect at whatever this task is, but you're a smart guy. So even kind of adjusting that language, which, you know, that's basic CBT, you know, that's addressing, you know, distorted thinking. What I found when I'm talking to my patients about cognitive distortions is, I tell them right off the bat, I say, what I do very frequently is overgeneralization. I'll take one piece of information and I'll extrapolate it out to be, the responsible for everything. It's the principal indicator of all things. But that's just something that I'm sort of guilty of doing sometimes. But once I recognize that I'm doing it, to be able to refocus and say, wait a second, like, this this is just one thing. This doesn't mean that this situation is, you know, emblematic of who I am as a person. It's just how I reacted to this one situation. And, you know, I'm not a bad person for reacting in a way that I reacted.
And that sounds like real self-compassion, the ability not only to be kind to yourself, but to be honest with yourself and to see yourself as you are and to recognize mistakes and recognize that those are not the full story of who you are.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It sounds like you really, like me, you use and benefit a lot from CBT principles in your own life.
I definitely do, because it works. You know, I figure if you got something that works, why not use it?
Yes. Yes, exactly. You know, I want to ask you about, I was talking before, you've got a lot of things going on, and you have a couple of areas of your practice that I wanted to hear more about.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, one thing I was curious about, we're talking about self-care, is sleep. And I saw you treat insomnia, and I'm curious, what do you focus on? What's your insomnia treatment look like?
So the vast majority of patients that I see with any type of sleep problem, they have no awareness of sleep hygiene. So when I say sleep hygiene, they look at me like I'm speaking Mandarin. And when I start introducing the concept that the behaviors that you engage in throughout the course of a day strongly contribute to the sleep that you experience at night, those principles sometimes are foreign for patients. You know, a lot of times patients think that just because it's nighttime, I should be able to sleep 8 hours, wake up the next day. So I really love educating patients on what sleep is. I talk about the stages of sleep and how sleep is complex. It's not just you're awake or you're asleep. How there's brain activity of different levels while you're sleeping, and how it's really important that you engage in certain behaviors to increase and optimize that brain activity to the extent that you're not disrupting your sleep and you're not fragmenting your sleep cycles. So, you know, just sometimes just that basic education, you know, I can't tell you how many patients will come up to me and they're like, oh yeah, so I'll drink like a six pack just so I can get to sleep. And man, it knocks me out, but I feel so tired the next day. And like, I'm always so tired, you know, so they're sort of engaging in these concepts that really violate like basic norms of sleep hygiene. So, you know, just like an education is where I like to start. Mm-hmm. I like to incorporate elements of stimulus control. I like getting patients to, you know, develop a stronger sleep drive. You know, sometimes patients are going to bed at like 7:30 in the evening, and then they're waking up at like 2 o'clock in the morning and staying awake for 2 hours and trying to get back to sleep and mm-hmm. then sort of having fragmented sleep for the rest of the night. So I really try to emphasize like, how can we optimize that sleep to the point where you get a nice solid chunk of sleep in the middle and like throughout the night. So I'll say, you know, let's actually stay up a little bit later. What do you think? I mean, if you're waking up anyway for 2 hours in the middle of the night, why not just take those 2 hours and just bump it up a little bit? So then you go to bed a little bit later.
And do you ever find that's a tough sell for someone who comes to you saying, I'm not getting enough sleep? You say, well, you need to be in bed less.
Yeah. So, you know what's really funny? These are the So you asked like, what kind of things am I doing in my practice? One of the things that I'm so excited about are behavioral health appointments. And in those appointments, I'm actually able to sell basic CBT and health CBTI, which is CBT for insomnia for anyone who doesn't not familiar with it. I'm able to sell these concepts pretty quickly. You know, it's when I just explain to people, hey, you know, we've been studying this since like the 70s. Mm-hmm. And like, we kind of know like what works, and it's not always medication. In fact, a lot of the things that I'm going to explain to you are on the same level and in some cases more effective than taking a medication for your sleep. So I've been sort of honing and working on the cell of it, for a few years now. So, you know, I would say most of the patients that I meet with, they're able to buy into the concepts. The one part that's usually people kind of turn their heads when I say it is when I tell them that they're in bed doing too many activities.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, like, if you're in bed doing anything other than sleep, your body's making those connections. So that's usually when they have like that aha moment and they're like, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then we really hone in on the concept of, you know, staying in bed. I think that the intervention that I have the most trouble with people following is when I tell them, like, if you're in bed for more than about 20 minutes and you're not asleep, then get out of bed, do something boring.
Oh my goodness. I agree. That's usually the one people are least likely to comply with. And to be honest, same's true for me. That's the one, you know, like, oh man, I should get up, but.
Right. So I've said the same thing. So what I do is, this is what I've done. Instead of getting out of bed all the way, I'll just kind of sit up in my bed, and that's when I'll do my breathing techniques.
Mm.
And then I'll count down from 1,000 and I'll take a nice diaphragmatic breath in between each number. And usually by the time I get to like 984, I'm pretty bored and tired. So sometimes that's a tough sell. So what I encourage people to do is just push your bedtime back. That's like the easier sell. You know, try to do something to stay awake. Don't drink coffee, obviously. Don't do anything that's going to like mess with your system. But try to like, you know, do something to stay awake and push your bedtime back so you can develop a nice, strong sleep drive. So your body's like just begging you to get to bed. And if you get that sensation, you're probably going to get more than 3 hours of sleep. Your body's probably going to let you sleep until hopefully maybe the morning time, 7 o'clock or so.
And that's really a life-changing experience to get your sleep back on track, especially for someone who may have had insomnia for a decade or more.
Yeah, it's bad for business, but it's good for people.
Yes, it's, you know, right.
I had this patient, he came in and he's like, yeah, you know, I get like 1 hour of sleep and I'm restless the entire night and yeah, I'm taking these naps during the day and I'm looking at them and we had one appointment and I said, I'm going to give you some recommendations. I don't think you're going to see me again. So this isn't going to be good for me, but I think I can probably help you with your sleep just if you follow these recommendations. So I wrote down 6 recommendations, handed it to him, and then we scheduled a follow-up. So he called me like midweek and he was like, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to come back anymore.
Yeah, and that was that.
How was that?
So the behavioral health practice, these appointments that you were describing. So one factor about them is they're brief, right? They're 30-minute appointments.
Yeah, they're brief.
And what else? Tell me more. What else goes into this practice?
So it's so cool, and I learned this when I was over at McGuire Air Force Base. I was in a program called the Behavioral Health Optimization Program. So my role was really to work with the physicians, nurse practitioners. I was actually embedded in their primary healthcare clinic. So I was just another doctor that was in the clinic. And whenever patients had certain conditions, so let's say they had stress on the job or some mild to moderate anxiety, if they had panic attacks, a death in the family. So whatever condition related to mental health that they were experiencing, if their symptoms were like mild to moderate, a lot of times I would really try to treat those symptoms in-house. And I was pretty successful. And the program makes it so the clinician is going to be pretty successful to treat those types of patients within anywhere from 1 to 4 30-minute appointments. That was kind of tough for me to swallow when I first started training in that model, because I'm like, well, therapy is supposed to be an hour. You know, like we're supposed to do this like once a week for an hour, and it's supposed to happen for like at least 3 months, right? So what I learned was if you come up with targeted interventions and you really narrow the scope of what's the active problem. So if somebody comes to me for sleep problems and they say, yeah, I've had trouble sleeping for, you know, 2 years. And it just so happened that 2 years ago is when they got back from Afghanistan. And while they weren't in a combat setting, they did have to do missions throughout the night. So their sleep schedule changed and they were maybe a flyer. So they're flying around doing missions and doing certain activities. So once they got back, getting back on a healthy sleep schedule just wasn't something that they were able to do. And sometimes a person's job switches, so people do like a swing shift, or they do a mid shift, and then they do like a day shift, and that might change over the course of several months. So trying to figure out how you can take that 8-hour chunk and kind of move it around so you're not cheating on your sleep. But anyway, what we would do is try to figure out, all right, well, what is the problem? How long has the problem been going on? What's contributing to the problem? What reduces the problem? And, you know, just other general information like, you know, do you take any psychiatric medications? Have you ever had any mental health history? So really what I'm trying to do is weed out any more chronic conditions or any more severe conditions, because if those are at play, then that's when I would want to refer out. But if it's something that's mild to moderate, and I think it can be treated successfully with, CBT interventions, then we just go ahead and get started. And I was really amazed with the success of that program. And I was really amazed with the patient feedback. And to this day, I stand behind it. This is the best job I've ever worked at, because there's the only job in psychology where I was able to meet with a patient and tremendous distress. You know, sometimes patients were crying before they even started talking to me, just walking into the room, just crying, just overwhelmed with their own negative thoughts and with their own emotions, and not able to sort of see which way was up. But just sort of meeting patients where they are, explaining to them, you know, that these feelings don't necessarily have to be permanent. These are normal reactions that people have to stressful situations, and emphasizing that, you know, you're not a broken person, you're not a damaged person. That, in addition to identifying what are those most problematic contributors to their distress, and just identifying that and kind of keeping it moving. And sometimes it's as simple as, somebody comes in and they're feeling really tired and they're feeling not motivated. And then they tell me, well, I used to be a bodybuilder and, you know, I can't do that anymore because I had this bad injury like a year ago. And so now I have to give up on the thing that makes me happy. In which case we try to identify, well, how can we still embrace something connected to that bodybuilding concept? So maybe if you hurt your ankle, are there still activities that you can do that involve your upper body, where you could still focus on building other muscles? Are you involved with physical therapy? So that might be an actual referral that I make to physical therapy, in which case we get them doing some activities that are strengthening those muscles or that area that's damaged. Finding other ways to instill hope. Are they involved socially? What's their relationship with any partner? Do they have any children? So what things like actually bring value? And it's really surprising, but that can all happen in 30 minutes. So patients leave with so much more hope. Patients leave feeling better, feeling energized, feeling like they don't have to feel depressed and down all the time. And then upon follow-ups, you know, the reason why I love the job so much, it's because patients would actually be so much better by the next time they saw me, usually within 2 weeks.
So it's really high impact work, it sounds like. And it starts with making sure the person is, or the treatment is appropriate for the person, and then really honing in on what's going to be the focus.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not for everyone. It's not for patients who are actively psychotic, patients with who are in the severe symptom stages of severe mental illness. It's not necessarily for those more some moderate to severe conditions, but for so many people who think that they're sort of damaged beyond repair, actually, a lot of the patients that I treated, they actually did have chronic and severe symptoms, but they were able to benefit from these brief appointments because somehow they were able to reconnect with those things that bring them value and bring them purpose. And even through doing that, they were able to better engage and better manage their symptoms. Sometimes the intervention was talk with your psychiatrist and maybe change your medications. I have one patient who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and she totally stopped all of her medications. And she was on some pretty heavy bipolar medications. And right now we're just treating her for anxiety. And she's doing great. She's doing amazing. Mm. The basic interventions, by me empowering her and validating her feelings, letting her know you're not crazy. I would feel the same way if someone spoke to me in this way or treated me this way. Like, that's a natural reaction. That's not your diagnosis. There's some hammering going on.
No problem.
But essentially, yeah, you know, just sort of normalizing patients' experiences.
I just assumed you were pounding on your desk for emphasis.
I think they're doing some repairs outside. It's been going on for a couple of weeks.
So I'm sure there will be many people that will be drawn to that type of approach. I wanted to ask you about another part of your practice that people may or may not be familiar with. So that's the forensic part. I knew nothing about it until I knew nothing about the field until I was on my internship at Encore Psychiatric Hospital, and half of the year my placement was in the secure unit. So I was exposed to a lot of the concepts there. And I think when people hear forensic psych, they think of things maybe if they're of a certain generation, they think of Jodie Foster and Silence of the Lambs, right? Or they think about CSI. So you're helping to track down serial killers. Or can you see, so, you know, if I were, well, I am a person, what might bring me, for example,
You're not a robot, right?
That's right. Yeah. Oh no. I'll edit out that part. that's just between you and me, Jason. But what might bring a robot or a person into contact with a forensic psychologist?
So I look at, and maybe I don't have like the classic definition of forensic psychology at hand, but I kind of look at it as the intersect between psychology and the criminal justice system and whatever facet that might be. I used to work in a prison. I actually worked in a couple of prisons. My first training experience was a prison in Kentucky. And just walking in there and providing treatment, individual therapy, group therapy to the inmates. Currently, my practice is not working in prisons, but we receive referrals through probation and through the court system. So that's another element. But your description was funny because it seems like that would be kind of exciting if I was able to like track down serial killers and do that kind of fun stuff. I don't even know how a psychologist would track down a serial killer, but I imagine it would be a bit more boring to look at. Our practice is receiving referrals through probation. We're talking with patients, and I think there's a certain tendency to when someone's convicted of a crime to just kind of like sum them up as, well, you're just a criminal, whatever, you get what you get. And I think, to a certain degree, something that gets lost is all people are essentially that. They're people. And by acknowledging that they're people, then you have to acknowledge that people have the same highs and lows. People experience anxiety. People experience depression. Some of these concepts are really universal. And when you understand how someone's experience of emotional dysregulation may contribute to criminal behavior, then in many cases, that's the best way to help them not reproduce that criminal behavior. While the criminal justice system, tends to rely on, punishment, as a psychologist, Seth, we know that punishment is not the best reinforcer of behavior. I think understanding patients, treating all patients the same, treating patients with respect and dignity, that's really been a hallmark of my treatment, and it's worked out well. And I think all my patients, they really appreciate the fact that I treat them all with respect and dignity, no matter what brought them to me.
And people who may well have been written off by a lot of society, and I remember from my own work in the secure unit, learning that there are people who'd been through just, I mean, things that were unimaginable, you know, maybe even at the hands of their parents, you know, the abuse or severe neglect that they'd suffered. And while it doesn't erase or excuse their whatever crimes they may have committed, and it may be cold comfort to the survivors or victims of their crimes, it does expand your understanding of the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that goes back to, it's easy to just kind of size people up as they're all criminals, or they're animals, they're not human, but I think that's the sort of simple way to categorize people. But yeah, when you actually get in and you start to understand what motivates a person, what drives a person, some of the scary things is you talked about the way that someone may have grown up. And some of the more scary moments that I've experienced is the sort of realization that I may have turned out like some of the people that I'm treating if I had gone through some of those same life experiences.
Yes.
And I think that's a really eye-opening aspect of working with people in the criminal justice system, because, you know, you look at – sometimes you just look at a charge and you kind of you sum someone up and you say, all right, well, you know, here's this charge that we got, or here's that charge. And some of these charges are pretty intense. I mean, I provided treatment to people who've been convicted of some really serious charges. But when you get behind it and you kind of understand, you know, like, well, where is this person coming from? You know, what possesses someone to make these types of life decisions, whether it be through just poor emotional regulation, or whether it be through substance abuse problems, or you know, a strange thing that I recognized when I was working in the prison is that it actually was, to a degree, a miniature psychiatric hospital. And there were people in the prison that were actively psychotic, and they had been actively psychotic since they were incarcerated. So you look at how, in some ways, the mental health system is failing, and you know, in some ways, the criminal justice system is failing some of these people, where they're not getting proper care and proper treatment, so they don't sort of recidivate.
Mm. So this practice of forensic psychology could be helpful both to the people receiving services and to broader society.
Absolutely.
So any intersection then, psychology, the law, we could find forensic psychologists that would include things, I guess, on the civil side, things like custody disputes. That would be a forensic psychologist role there, maybe to do custody evaluations, for example.
I mean that's, and again, I don't want to speak too, because I don't know if I consider myself a forensic psychologist. I guess maybe I should if I do forensic work, but I also do behavioral health work. So in one hand, I'm a behavioral health psychologist. I guess I don't really like putting those titles on, but yeah, I would say if you're working with the criminal justice system, if you're working with lawyers, if you're working with judges, probation officers, parole officers, that's some type of forensic practice, I would say, in general.
Yeah, and probably for most psychologists, at some point, whether or not you're seeking it, you'll find yourself bumping into the legal world. You know, if you have maybe a patient you worked with who is having a hearing for disability, you may be asked to testify about their ability to work. Or if you have someone who is charged with a crime that maybe isn't the focus of treatment, but the judge might want a person to testify about how their symptoms may have contributed, or things like that.
Yeah, and I've always had very positive experiences whenever I've had to go in and testify in court or whenever I'm speaking with attorneys and they're just asking for my professional opinions. I think by and large, the legal system really respects the work that psychologists do. They respect our evaluations and they respect our expert opinions. You know, when we can have any type of input, I see it as heavily valued. So I think there's a real benefit whenever a psychologist is able to step foot into any type of legal proceeding, because you're just bringing a knowledge base and expertise that is uncommon.
And that's been my experience too. I mean, I tend to be pretty anxious when I'm called to testify, to speak before a judge. But yes, I often have that same feeling. You know, I've taken a lot of your time here today, Jason, so which I really appreciate.
My pleasure.
We'll wrap up in a minute, but I wanted to ask you just a
couple more
things.
Ask me whatever you want. This is great for me.
Great.
We
same
keep
here.
On going.
Yes. Well, let me ask you about, we've touched on a number of principles that I think could apply to anyone's life, things like self-care, about the way that we talk to ourselves. Is there one thing you'd like to leave listeners with, one practice they might take with them? Maybe this is in a kind of in the spirit of behavioral health, a kind of quick and impactful intervention.
An intervention to leave the listeners with.
A take-home message could be a suggestion to live more fully, anything you like.
Well, it might sound kind of sappy to say be kind to yourself, but that kind of sappiness actually it definitely helped me. You know, I would say, you know, stay driven, stay tough, but also be kind to yourself. You know, take a look at yourself and your life, and just kind of project out and say, you know, when I'm in my golden years, am I doing the things right now that I can really look back on and appreciate?
And I love that balance, that it's strength and expecting strength from ourselves and recognizing we have strength with kindness. I think often our objection to self-kindness is feeling like it's somehow weak, or we're just going to give up any kind of goals or striving, and recognizing that we can be compassionate with ourselves without being indulgent.
Yeah. And maybe a good little technique to leave on, I say this to a lot of my patients, is, you know, what would you say to a good friend? Start saying that to yourself. How would you treat a good friend? You know?
Yes, and the good friends aren't necessarily the ones who just say yes to everything that we say, but they challenge us when we need to be challenged.
Yeah. Definitely.
I think sometimes people are I'm torn at times, because it seems like the default as a therapist is to offer kind of a soft response to encourage people to go easy on themselves, cut themselves some slack. But I do find not uncommonly that what a person wants, along with that acceptance and empathy, is an encouragement to kind of kick themselves in the butt and say, like, you know what? No, you're better than this. You got this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think ultimately people want the truth. I mean, if they're gonna get over all the obstacles that it takes to actually sit down an appointment with a psychologist, and there's a lot of obstacles prior to doing something like that, once they sit down, I think they really want the truth. They really want an honest opinion. And that's why I always say, you know, I'll tell you, you know, what I honestly believe, and you might not like it. But I think that's why you came here. Mm-hmm. I think people kind of do. They want that. They don't want everything to be flowery and for everything to be kind of like, you know, pie in the sky. And I tell them, you know, that's not really even therapy. You know, it's not. People come to me and they expect me to say something positive all the time. And, you know, sometimes it's disingenuous to be positive.
Yes.
You know, if you're suffering from the grief of a immediate family member, then, you know, looking at the bright side is really, it's not really appropriate sometimes. Sometimes it's important to experience deep sadness and deep hurt and deep loss. And sometimes that's the way to get through so you can start to reconnect with that happiness. So I think sometimes people are surprised when I give them that, but I think that's real. I think that's genuine. I think part of the human experience is pain and suffering sometimes. And maybe that's the sort of existential part of me that I learned back in Louisville. But I think there's value in that.
Yes, yes, and acknowledging sometimes, like, life just sucks right now. That's how things are.
But to not wallow in that, and to not say that life is always going to suck, but just to be able to embrace negative emotions and embrace them without engaging in destructive behavior, to embrace them while doing something to eventually bring yourself back to a place that where you're at peace. I think patients ultimately want they don't want pie in the sky. They want real solutions and real hope. And one of the things that provides me so much comfort is that I think that I'm part of helping them to develop real solutions and real hope. You know, I don't just give people like positive affirmations all the time. Sometimes there's a place for positive affirmations. I'm not knocking that, but I don't just always look at the bright side of things or sort of give a pie in the sky answer for everything.
Well, Jason, clearly you're doing a lot of really good work and work that's changing the lives of people. I have no doubt that there are many people in this world who are enjoying their life more than they otherwise would be, and whose families have their loved one back in a way that they wouldn't if not for your work with them.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you.
So, and I do want to give people a way of finding you if they'd like to learn more or if they're looking for treatment. What's the best way to for people to find you?
Yeah, so anyone can access my website. My company is called Behavioral Health and Anxiety Reduction. So that's a mouthful. So we kind of condensed it to letter B, the word health, letter A, the letter R. So it's behealthar.com. You get what I did right there?
Yeah.
Be healthier?
No. Oh, my goodness. I'm slightly embarrassed to say I didn't. That's great. That worked out so well. Was that after the fact? Did you have BHAR first and then realize?
No. You know, really what I wanted to do, and I struggle with this name so much, I wanted to have a name where people knew exactly what to expect.
Yes.
I wanted to be straightforward. I didn't want people to think that I sold pizzas or anything. So I said behavioral health because I love the behavioral health appointments. So I wanted people to know that right there. And then I wanted to let them know, like, hey, this is what I do. I do anxiety reduction. I do like helping people to manage their anxiety, regulate their anxiety, and live healthier lives. So I wanted those two concepts right there, right up front. I know it's a mouthful. It's a big name. But that's kind of like the best that I could think of to capture everything that I wanted the company to be about. So typically what we do is we just kind of shorten things because that's a lot to say. So a lot of my patients and a lot of my employees, we just call it BAR, BAR for short. But the website is www.behealthar.com, be healthier.
Jason, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate the opportunity, Seth.
Yes, and I'll let you go and schedule your vacation now.
Thanks for reminding me.
All right, take good care.
Take care, Seth.